So tonight I would like to offer a talk on why meditating out in nature is or can be so important, so transformative. Why the kind of practice that we received instruction in this morning can literally change the way we experience the world and ourselves. And the first thing to notice, I think, is just how important it has been for so many important spiritual figures, starting with the Buddha, right? We know that when the Buddha left home on his spiritual quest, where did he go? He went out into the natural world. In fact, he seems to have had a really special relationship with trees his whole lifetime. He was born in Lumbini Grove. When his mother went into premature labor, there's a fascinating story about he was sitting under a tree when his father was doing some ritual plowing. And he sort of went spontaneously into a kind of samadhi, but it was under a tree. And we know he practiced out in the natural world, he did his ascetic practices, he meditated, and he eventually awakened under the Bodhi tree. And that wasn't the end of it. It's not as though he just sort of went back into the city or anything. I mean, he mostly lived, taught, and eventually died outside. So for the Buddha, the natural world was really, really important. It was somehow connected with the core of his practice, the core of his transformation. And it's not only the Buddha. Even in the Buddhist tradition, the most famous of all the Tibetan yogis was Milarepa, who lived and practiced by himself in a Himalayan cave. Supposedly sustained himself by eating thistles. I don't think they were Canada thistles. Supposedly his skin turned green from that was all he had. But he supposedly went all the way to Buddhahood in one lifetime. That's the story.
Just from eating thistles.
Shall we try?
What's for dinner tomorrow?
I've got plenty.
And there's other great Buddhist examples. I mean, the probably the two foremost Thai monastics of the last century, Ajahn Chah and Buddhadasa Bhikkhu. They were basically forest practitioners. But it's not only in the Buddhist tradition. I love the story about Jesus after he was baptized by John the Baptist. What did he do? He went off into the desert where he fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, and that was clearly really important part of his transformation. Or we can go back earlier to someone like Moses, who actually may not have existed, but according to the legend, I mean, he would like encounter God, but it was by himself in the desert or on the mountaintop. Muhammad, right? According to the story, Muhammad was off on his own kind of spiritual quest. He was meditating or praying in a cave when the archangel Gabriel appeared and basically gave him the text of the Quran. I mean, when you put all that together, it's very suggestive, isn't it? It's like there's something powerful about getting away from society, getting away from civilization, and going out like that. Today, of course, we mostly meditate inside, you know, zendos, dojos, meditation halls. And obviously there's advantages in that we can control the, you know, the temperature and the screens keep out insects and so forth. But we may nonetheless wonder, you know, is something lost? Are we overlooking, are we missing something by the fact that we sort of take that for granted, that our practice is so often a kind of urban practice? So what is it about meditating in the natural world? Actually, I want to back up a little bit and sort of create the context for this kind of indirectly to really understand, I think, the important point here. Recently, I've been quite struck by something Joseph Campbell said, the mythologist, professor. He said a lot of interesting things, but one of them in particular really stuck out for me, and I find my mind goes back to it. He said, or probably wrote, a lot of the problem with religions happens because people take metaphors literally. They take symbols literally. And there's another scholar, an Irish scholar, John Dominic Crossan, famous, well-known New Testament scholar, who also talks about this. And he said, I am not saying that the ancient people understood the teachings literally and we today are smarter because we understand them symbolically. It's the opposite. The ancient peoples understood that the teachings were symbolic, and we today are dumber because we take them literally. Wow. I mean, one example that comes to mind for me, heaven, right? I mean, most of us were raised Christian, so we all know heaven, right? Heaven is where you go after you die if you've been good, according to the way that the church teaches, right? But what did Jesus say? That's what the church says. What did Jesus say? This is from the Gospel of Luke. On being asked by the Pharisees when the kingdom of God would come, Jesus replied, "The coming of the kingdom of God isn't something that will be observed, nor will people say, 'Here it is,' or 'There it is.' Because the kingdom of God is already among you, or the kingdom of God is in your midst." It's right here and now. Often that's translated wrongly, the kingdom of God is within you, but it's actually amongst you. You know, we could say the kingdom of God is right here. Why don't we see it? So I can't help wondering, maybe that teaching has been lost and instead the church panders, I think, to our fear of death. We all want to be reassured we don't really die. So heaven is where your soul goes after you die, or where your soul can go. But this also applies to Buddhism. Coming back to Buddhism. This issue about metaphor and literal. In the Theravada tradition, the ultimate goal of our spiritual practice is not to be reborn, physically be reborn, because this world is the world of suffering, right? Dukkha, the world of craving and delusion, and the idea is not to be reborn into it. It's not quite clear where or what nirvana is, but it's definitely generally understood as the end of physical rebirth. But in the Zen tradition, we talk about the unborn, realizing the unborn. But it's not something that you do after you die. You can realize it right here and now. There was this great Japanese teacher, Bankei, who talked about that was his central enlightenment, realizing the unborn. It's a way of experiencing the world right here and now. And you get people like Thich Nhat Hanh, too, saying, I'm going to quote him. I laugh when I think how I once sought paradise as a realm outside of the world of birth and death. It's right here in the world of birth and death that the miraculous truth is revealed. But it's not the laughter of someone who suddenly acquires a great fortune or the laughter of someone who's won a great victory. It is rather the laughter of one who, after having painfully searched for something for a long time, finds it one morning in the pocket of his coat. Thich Nhat Hanh also said, quoting, Nirvana is extinction, the extinction of notions and concepts, including the concepts of birth and death, being, non-being, coming and going. It's the ultimate dimension of life, a state of coolness, peace, and joy. It's not a state to be achieved after you die. You can touch nirvana right now by breathing, walking, drinking your tea mindfully. You have been nirvanized since the very beginning. Everything and everyone is dwelling in nirvana. Everyone and everything has always been dwelling in nirvana. So that makes the question, well, why don't we realize that? What's the problem? If what we're looking for is right here, Hakuin, the greatest Japanese Zen master, Nirvana's right here before your eyes. This very place is the lotus land. Your very body is the Buddha. If all that's true, why don't we experience right here and now as nirvana? And that's what brings us back to what practice in the natural world can do to us, and I think a better understanding of the problem. Perhaps the greatest of the Buddhist philosophers, Nagarjuna, he made the same point by saying there is absolutely no difference between nirvana and samsara. No difference whatsoever. But he also went further to sort of explain the relationship, why it is that we sometimes experience the world as suffering and sometimes we experience it as nirvana. His most famous quotation, ultimate serenity, another word for nirvana. It's the coming to rest of all ways of taking things, the repose of name things. The repose, the rest, he's talking about names, he's talking about language. No dharma has been taught by any Buddha for anyone, anywhere. But he makes this really important connection, right? The repose of name things. So basically what he's pointing us at is language. And I think it's pretty clear the basic idea is we don't usually experience the world or ourselves in the world. We don't experience the world as it is. We experience it structured, constructed by our ways of thinking about it, right? So samsara is a particular way of structuring the world, and nirvana is about undoing that. That's the repose of name things, right? And that makes sense if you think about meditation. What are we doing when we meditate? We're letting go of concepts, letting go of ideas, letting go of language, right? Letting go. And this is a basic truism, I think, of contemporary philosophy too. How when we experience the world, we normally experience it organized. In particular, we divide it up into distinct things, right? So right now we have rocks, logs, fire, my water bottle that I keep losing. And the interesting thing about that is we don't just put labels on things, but by putting labels on things, we know what to do with them. Right? So when I see this, I actually see it as a water bottle. That's important, especially when we're up here and we have to keep drinking water all the time, right? That function, to identify it, to give it the concept water bottle, is to give it a function. This can help me. This is what I need to use to avoid getting dehydrated, getting a headache, whatever. And notice, here's the third part to it. Notice that functions are connected with our desires, with our cravings. These three things work together. We have the names, which identify the functions, and I can use the water bottle to satisfy a desire, or I can buy a chocolate bar for the same reason, or a bottle of beer. But basically what all this amounts to, and I think this is really important, this goes to the heart of it, what this amounts to is that we structure the world so that we see everything in a utilitarian way, especially in urban areas, especially in cities. Language enables us to use everything to do something, to go somewhere, to satisfy some desire. And we are so caught up in that way of perceiving the world that we're constantly overlooking something fundamental. Does this make any sense? Think about an urban environment. So for many of us, Boulder, right? You go downtown, it's like everything is there to help us do something or go somewhere or acquire something, right? The roads, the cars, the bicycles, the shops, the supermarkets, the restaurants. You've got the telephones, you've got the electricity, you've got the water, you've got the bathrooms. Everything is organized in this utilitarian way. So for us, what happens is the world becomes structured into this whole utilitarian world. And by growing up, we learn to fit into this. We learn how to play that game. We learn how to use all of these different things to do what we want to do and to go where we want to go, right? We learn how to drive a car. We learn how to use the bathroom. We learn how to use the telephones. We learn how to walk on the sidewalk. And we also extend that utility to the people who are also understood in a utilitarian way. The servers, the cooks, the salespeople in the shops, right? They're all parts, they're all functions. We treat them as functions. And we do it very smoothly. It's unconscious. We do it so smoothly and usually so efficiently, we don't realize that there's another whole dimension here that we're constantly overlooking. Now we come out here to this beautiful natural setting, and we can still do it, we can still continue that, right? I mean, people can look at the trees and look at them as, sources of lumber. I remember reading some guy, some forester, who said, you know, when I look at a tree, what I see is a stump with a big pile of dollar bills on it, right? Or we can treat the water in the same way. We know how precious water is these days, that we don't have enough of it. So we can still continue this utilitarian way of relating to the natural world, but we don't have to. Yeah? Especially when we do the kind of practice that Johann was talking about this morning, in the seeing, just the seen, in the hearing, just the heard, in the feeling, just the felt. When we're doing that, what are we doing? We're letting go of the concepts, we're letting go of perceiving all of the things that we see as utilities, utensils for us to use. In the process, we're opening up to a different way of experiencing this dimension that we've been overlooking. There's one more essential aspect to this process of, you could say, constructing the world so that we see it in a certain way. And we're never aware we're doing this, because in the process of growing up and learning a language and learning how to do things, we just get socialized into it naturally, right? We're never aware of what's actually going on. But the most important thing that is constructed in this process is the self, is the sense of a separate self that's doing these things, the sense of separation. One of the important Buddhist philosophies called Yogacara, this is the heart of its claim. The basic problem is that we grasp. We're grasping at things. The eyes grasp. You know? We see it in a certain way. And the act of grasping, that's actually what creates the delusion of separation. It creates the sense of a grasper at the same time as it creates the sense of a thing outside ourselves, you know, the sense of separation. And that's important, because by practicing in the way that Johann was talking today, by letting go of language, functions, treating everything as utensils to satisfy desires. When we do that, we're also indirectly kind of deconstructing the delusion of a separate self. There's a kind of a letting go. Dogen, the Japanese Zen master, said famously, "To study the Buddha Dharma is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self, to let go of yourself in this practice. To let go of yourself is to realize your intimacy or your non-duality with all things." What Dogen is pointing at is the importance, again, of letting go of this constant using, dividing up the world into separate things and then using them to try to satisfy endless desires. What would it be like to experience the world, a world in which we weren't doing that? What did William Blake say? Famous line I expect many of you have heard. "If the doors of perception were cleansed, cleaned up, purified, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. But man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern." Narrow chinks. We just... It's interesting how psychologists of perception, you know, they basically say, normally when we're looking at something, we're not really paying that much attention. We just pay enough attention to identify it. Okay, this is water bottle. Then we're not really focusing, we're not really seeing the water bottle, right? I'm using it, I may or may not be using it to drink from, but we're not really actually paying that much attention. And that's why our path is learning to pay deeper attention. Clinging to concepts, functions, and cravings is how we close ourselves up, in Blake's sense. And letting go of them is how we can clean the doors of perception. William Blake also wrote, "To see the world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower." Maybe some of us were doing that today. "Hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour." The reference to time illuminates another aspect of this, right? Because when we're treating everything as a utensil, that is, as a means to an end, most of the time what we're doing is we're always going somewhere else. we never are where we are. We're treating right here and now as a means to get to somewhere else, somewhere better. It means so often we are devaluing right here and now because we're preoccupied with getting somewhere else, right? The satisfaction of our desire. That's the whole point of the Buddhist critique of desire and craving, is we're by craving and getting caught up in satisfying desires, we're missing something about right here and now, that really there's nothing lacking right here and now, but we're trying to get somewhere else. So that's another important aspect of our meditation here, of our practice, is, you know, when we're walking mindfully on one of these paths, in the most important sense, we're not really going anywhere, right? We're not trying to get somewhere. From one angle, you can say, okay, yeah, but really, that's not the important thing. The important thing is just this step, just this moment. We can let go of that usual way of relating to the present, always trying to get something in the future out of it. Now, does all of this, what I've tried to say, does all of this help us understand why we so often delight in the innocence of little children and pets who aren't playing that game, right? That's why we love them so much. We love that joy, right? Does this explain why we love music and dancing so much, right? I mean, if you're dancing to get somewhere or to impress somebody, I mean, it's like, oh, yeah, you can do that, but dancing and music are a relief. They give us the opportunity to let go of this workaday, always utilitarian way of relating to the world, right? Young children in particular haven't learned yet that life is a serious business and you've got to start preparing for it. Right? I wonder if Jesus was alluding to this when he said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Which, to say it again, is right here. Maybe the kingdom of heaven is closer than we realize. Yeah? Maybe nirvana is closer than we realize. So, does this help us understand why we love nature so much? It's not only the pets, right? Think of the moose. We love watching the moose. We saw them yesterday. I didn't. Yeah. We look at the beautiful trees and the wildflowers, and the wind and the babbling brook. None of that is playing that utilitarian, breaking things up. Even the creek, it's not really trying to get anywhere. Yeah. And I believe that's why practice in the natural world can be so powerful, so transformative, by helping us let go of this utilitarian way that we're normally preoccupied or stuck in. It's not that that's bad. Obviously, we need it to function, right? But when we think, when we believe that's the only reality, that that is the only way to experience the world, then we're cutting off, we're completely losing or overlooking this other dimension that children and pets and William Blake realized. We find nature healing even when we don't understand why or how. But clearly it's connected with the fact that it offers us an escape from this, an alternative. So the reason I started out earlier talking about metaphor and literal and all this, so often in religions, including Buddhism, we're trying to transcend this world, right? Trying to transcend this reality. Maybe Christians, they want to go to this higher, better place, heaven. Or Buddhists want to attain some nirvana. And the whole point of what I'm trying to say is that what if we understand transcendence metaphorically? That the important thing in our practice is to transcend this usual utilitarian way of living in the world and open up, let go, to experience this other side of reality. Which, as we know and as we need, is incredibly healing. What do you think? Does that make sense? That's all I have to say, but if people want to share or ask something, I think we have time. Sorry?
I really appreciated your conclusion. I was raised in the Christian church, and I've always had trouble with nirvana because it does seem so similar to heaven, and we are here. So I'm really grateful for the point you made.
My suspicion is that for the Buddha, in fact, textually, I could point some, you know. It's right here now, like Jesus, the kingdom of heaven is right here, right? Kingdom of God. But somehow, you know, the institution, and it also connects with fear of death, right? You want to offer some teaching that seems to assuage that fear. Talks about a post-mortem reality.
How does that connect, though, with getting off the wheel of birth and rebirth in the Buddhist tradition, right? The goal there is to sort of, what, disappear?
Right. Well,
so that seems like a disparate kind of goal.
Well, it's actually interesting because when you talk about the wheel of rebirth, you're talking about those five or six realms, right?
Yeah.
According to traditional Buddhist teaching, and you know, you find it in Tibet too, and early Buddhism, there are these six different realms we can be born into. And one of them is this realm, but there's also the animal realm. There's the hungry ghost realm, where the hungry ghosts have very tiny throats but very big bellies, so they're always hungry. And there's the hell realm, torture, suffering. There's the heaven realm, a realm of great pleasure, but it's impermanent. due to good karma, you might dwell there for a while, but then when your good karma wears off, you'll be reborn somewhere else. What's interesting is that Trungpa in particular, I don't know if he was the first, but he said we can understand these realms, this wheel of rebirth, metaphorically too, right? So when I hate someone and I really want to hurt them, that's like being reborn into the hell realm. Or if I'm in kind of a food trip where I can't get enough chocolate or something like that, that could be the hungry ghost realm. The idea of rebirth here, yeah, we're being reborn all the time according to what's going on in our minds, what we're identifying with and what we're, right? So it's by letting go of these cravings in the mind that we are reborn. You know, when there's a new craving, there's a new rebirth. So birth and rebirth can be understood metaphorically too in terms of our everyday lives and how we relate to the thoughts and the feelings and the desires that are constantly arising.
They say that Americans live in the hungry ghost realm because we can never get enough.
Consumerism.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah. I'm sorry?
I said, unfortunately, it's just not just Americans, it's spread around the world.
Oh, sure. Mm.
Yeah. I have a question, David.
Sure.
Sylvie. Like, you mentioned that the utilitarian society, like the society that we live in, that
Utilitarian?
Utilitarian, thank you. It's something necessary, right? And I was wondering, like, in your vision, like, how could there be an integration between the utilitarian society that allows things to be functional, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And at the same time having mm-hmm. a shift in consciousness mm-hmm. that could sort of, like, awaken our civilization to also seeing what's real and being here and now. So I'm just wondering if you have a vision in your mind. What mm-hmm. does that look like? I'm just curious.
It's interesting. If I think this is actually in the book. There's this famous first chapter of the Tao Te Ching, you know, that famous Taoist book. The way that can be weighed, or the Tao that can be Tao'd, is not the real Tao. The name that can be named is not the real. It's when you actually unpack that chapter, what it's really talking about is these two ways of experiencing the world. And what it basically comes down to is, you know, when a desire arises that you want to act on, then you're going to experience the world in a utilitarian way. But if you let go of that desire, then you can open up and experience what it calls the mystery of Tao. So that's the word, the Tao is the, or the Tao is the word that they use. So what it really comes down to is that through our practice, we become aware of this other dimension, this other side of the coin that's always been there. But the goal isn't to reject the utilitarian. It's to realize there are these two faces, two dimensions, two sides of the coin. And the real fruit of our practice is the freedom, the ability to dance from one to the other according to the situation. So it's not that one is good and one is bad. It's more they have different roles to play, you could say, in how we live. Mm-hmm. And it also applies, you know, to think about our ecological activism. Mm-hmm. I mean, that obviously implies a certain kind of utilitarian way of thinking and functioning. So we definitely need that, but we also need to be grounded in this other non-dual way of experiencing ourselves and or experiencing the world and ourselves in the world, or ourselves as the world. Yeah. Does that make any sense?
Say that the limbic system, it's our primitive part of our brain, is really focused on satisfying desire or reactivity and fear, and yet we're
survival.
Evolved to have the prefrontal cortex that can kind of balances it all out. So I don't know if there is an analogy there, but it just made me think of that it's kind of like the integration. It's not like denying that we have to satisfy our needs or that we have reactivity and it's wired in our evolution, and yet we can reach a place of peacefulness and calmness through these practices and integrate all of the brain. Does that relate?
Do you remember that quotation I mentioned last night from Shinryu Suzuki? You're all perfect just as you are, but you can use a little improvement too.
That's right.
You know, and they're both true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. Thanks for sharing.
Mindfulness actually changes the brain.
So I'm sorry?
Mindfulness, our practice changes our neural structure. So the amygdala, which identifies threat, actually gets smaller. Whereas when people have trauma, there's this large. They're perceiving excessive threat. So perhaps that's the first thing I noticed in practicing, was I was less reactive.
Huh.
Less caught up.
There's a really interesting book about that that's called Altered Traits.
Yeah.
And they really unpack the science behind mindfulness, and they make it very rigorous because they claim that a lot of the studies were not peer-reviewed and some of the studies were not done with the rigor that it should be done. And at the same time, yes, there is really longitudinal studies. It's kind of like a study of 100 studies where they concluded that meta-analysis where things like it really improves our attention. There's no shadow of a doubt that that's true. And that gray matter, there's still a lot to be sort of uncovered, apparently. But yes, to your point, yeah, apparently it really changes the brain in many ways.
So it's important that science has discovered neurological correlates to the kind of thing we're talking about, including the sense of self, which seems to be located in, you know, what's called the default network, and how that can change as well through practice. And also sometimes through, you see it happen with drugs, they watch people take LSD or something like that, and they can see how the default network changes.
Mm-hmm. Michael Pollan.
I'm sorry?
Michael Pollan, focusing, there's a series on it.
Yes, I just finished watching that wonderful, wonderful series, How to Change Your Mind.
Mm-hmm.
4 episodes on Netflix, and I think it's one of the best things I've ever seen on TV. So, yeah.
Is that the show you were talking about
yesterday?
I'm sorry?
Was that the show you were talking
yes.
about yesterday?
It's on my mind, because just finished it the night before we started, yeah.
What's it called again?
How to Change Your Mind. 4 episodes on Netflix.
Is that based on Pollan's book?
Yes. And that's a wonderful book, too.
It's a wonderful book.
Yeah.
So can I add something?
Go for it.
I want to bring this back to nature, because there's an aspect of what David was talking about that always strikes me in terms of how the mind creates things out of where there is or are in reality no things. And that's, you know, let's look at it very simply. David likes using his water bottle as an example, so I'll use mine. It's a little bit shinier than his, but it's basically... But does this have, just in the way you're looking at it, the way you see it, not in an invisible cosmic way, does this have defined boundaries?
Yes.
Yes, right? It has defined boundaries, right? It has a front and a back. You can see where it begins and where it ends, right? It's so... To a certain extent, at least in the most simple way, we can call this a thing or an object, and we know what we're talking about, right? And not only as a function, but as a form that we can circumscribe in space and time and say, this is this thing. It wasn't always this thing. So this gets fuzzy. I mean, this used to be ore in the ground and oil in the ground and that kind of thing. But let's not even go there. Let's keep it simple, okay? Now, take that tree over there, or take any tree. Does that have defined boundaries?
Yes.
Can you... It does?
Well, the tree itself does.
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Could you actually go and extricate that tree from the ground? And in the same way that this is separate and distinct from the air around it, separate that tree from the ground, physically.
Yes.
There's no biologist that would agree with you.
Well, I mean, you're saying, could you take that tree in its form and take it out of the ground?
You
sure.
Could, but you wouldn't get all of the tree out of the ground.
I thought we were being simple.
No, I'm being very simple.
The tree has rhizomes that connect it to every other tree around it. And the tree has no distinct form that begins and ends in a particular way. No plant does. You know, what plant biologists are realizing is that they're all connected. That these root structures get infinitely small and infinitely entangled, and there's no distinct tree.
Also the carbon dioxide and the...
Well, yeah, even not even getting into the complexities of...
I guess, you know, if you were to ask me, does that living tree have that?
Well, yeah, we're talking about a living tree. But... The point is that you cannot separate that living tree from the forest. It doesn't have its own distinct identity as a tree. That's only something that our mind puts on it. And the entire biosphere is actually that.
It's a whole new name. You can't tell the forest from the tree.
You can't tell the forest from the tree. Exactly. You know, these are just like labels that we put on things because they have utilitarian value. But if you really get down in the nitty-gritty of what they are, they're processes, they're interconnected, they're not things. And neither are we, because we're part of that same biosphere, that same interconnected process.
I appreciate the point, but when you buy a tree from a tree farm, what are you planting in your yard?
Well, they have given you part of the tree, which is why they go into shock when you stick them in the ground, because it's like they've been amputated.
Yeah.
So, on a functional level,
yeah.
on a functional level, you got a thing.
Enough. You have enough.
Called
there.
A tree that, you know,
yeah.
becomes. But some of that was left.
Right.
Yeah.
But the tree makes it up again and makes itself complete again.
Over time. It takes a long time, actually, for the tree to fully establish itself.
People, too, when you move them around.
This sounds to me like a traditional Buddhist teaching about interdependence or something like that?
Interbeing,
that's
Thich Nhat Hanh was really good at this.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, he said, when I see a flower, I see the sun and air and water and bees and soil. You know, he said it in a very beautiful poetic way. Mm.
I mean, it seems like it makes sense to me, you know, what you're saying about nature, but I'm not sure that, I don't know if I would agree or it makes sense to me that the water bottle exists outside of that interdependence. Like, just because it's a man-made thing, it doesn't actually, like, are you saying that makes it complete a separate
no,
identity
I actually,
of a thing?
I tried to oversimplify the example to see the difference. But I also said ultimately the water bottle came from ore in the ground.
It's just more
oil
obvious
in the ground.
To us with nature, the interconnectedness.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes sense.
But you're absolutely right. There's actually nothing that exists without everything else.
Which means it's all nature.
Yeah, I guess I find it odd how we do this, like, well, this is nature, and then we're going back to non-nature. Mm-hmm. We're not nature, and we're going to be with nature, like, all those distinctions I find strange.
Yeah. And that's because of our language. And it's not because of anything inherent in reality, it's just because, you know, like I said, last night or this morning, you know, being in nature, it's just being. we are nature, so. The words make this separation that isn't.
One of the ways that language kind of distorts or constructs reality is that in English, like all other Indo-European languages, we distinguish between nouns and verbs or subjects and predicates. We pick out things that then do things. Like, it's raining. What's the it that's raining? I mean, you know, I think Buddhism really implies a kind of process view. Everything is process, impermanent transformation, but we pick it out and we see things that are doing things.
As Robin Walkimer speaks to the grammar of animacy, that in indigenous languages, they don't have pronouns like we have pronouns, so there's no it. Right? Like the tree is a being, a person. They have a relationship with that. And that their language is very verb-based, and ours is very noun-based.
Yeah. Japanese, too, by the way, for the most part. Yeah.
And Lakota as well. You can talk all day in Lakota, and it's all verbs. And no pronouns, because there's no nouns.
Yeah.
At least one language in the past or future tense.
What about the language of mathematics?
Oh.
And physics? You know, if you look at the atomic structure, you know, it's math.
I would maybe add it's an unknowably weird thing that we use math to describe.
Yeah, and you get you get far enough into math and you get into Whitehead stuff and trying to understand the intrinsic basis of mathematics and what he calls the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. In other words, everything is a process.
Everything's a what?
Process. Everything.
But well, that would be back to the kingdom of... The kingdom is the interrelationship. Or the queendom.